Great Barrington Public Theater caps its eclectic season of new plays with the drama by David Mamet, The Christopher Boys Communion. It's in performance July 29th through August 8th at the Daniel Arts Center at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The Christopher Boys Communion is a gripping, chilling story of crime, evil, privilege, and justice, with an all-star cast of Berkshire actors. The play poses the question of just how much a parent will sacrifice to preserve one of their own. Playwright David Mamet is the author of many plays, including The Anarchist, Glengarry Glen Ross, American Buffalo, Race, Speed the Plow, and Sexual Perversity in Chicago, just to name a few. It is a great pleasure to welcome David Mamet back to the roundtable. How are you?
I'm terrific. It's good to be talking. I'm so glad that people are doing plays again.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's very nice to be talking about the arts again. From my understanding, this show has been in the works for a while. Was any of it written during the pandemic?
No, I think we got it out. I got it off my desk just before the pandemic. And I had this idea. I said, well, heck, I know the greatest actors in the world. They all live right around here. They're my closest friends. I'll just put the thing on in a neighborhood theater for 10 performances, and we'll sell every ticket. What could go wrong? Well, the answer to what could go wrong was 2 weeks later the pandemic hit.
Right.
But we got to play on.
When you think about what this period has been like for you, has it had an impact on your writing? Has it had an impact, I mean, obviously on the production of the work, but for you as a creator?
Well, it certainly had an impact on everyone, hasn't it? I mean, the financial and psychological and spiritual, because the question is, as posed by the world's greatest philosopher, who's, of course, Daffy Duck, say, what's going on here anyway?
Right.
So that's the question.
So do you feel that there will be a difference in your work or a reflection in your work of what we went through, are going through?
I don't think so. I think that the, I think as Bruno Bettelheim said, what the theater is an, might have even been Sigmund Freud, who said that what the arts are is they're a national dream life. And we don't dream about those things that we can solve rationally, right? We might worry all day long about whether or not we can afford a Ford Camaro or have to buy a Honda, but we don't dream about it. And so, though we might worry all day long about COVID, we don't dream about it.
So when it comes to this particular play, give us its origin story of when it started to tickle and say that this is something that you wanted to write about and explore.
Well, that's a very good question. I really don't know the answer. You know, that the thing about doing interviews, and that's why I stopped doing them, you know, except for Jimmy asked me, is I really don't know the answers to the question. It's just like if you say, well, why did you fall in love with that girl or that boy? You write down on a sheet of paper why you chose this person rather than that one. Well, you know, if you can do it, you're in for a bad time.
But if there has to be a moment where you write something down, you have an idea, and you think, this is something I'm going to pursue, or this is something I'm not going to pursue.
Yeah, but I got, you know, I have many too many volumes full of notebooks and notes and post-its and so forth. And every once in a while, I go back and say, oh, this is kind of interesting. And I think, to stop evading your question, it might have something to do with the four-piece, the dumb show is about the two cops. And I was writing it years ago, and then I was writing the story about the brutal murder years ago, and I said, well, aha, this is a great way to get into the story in the middle, isn't it? Which is, of course, where you always want to get into the story.
Why is the middle such a good place to get into the story?
Because, I'll tell you why. Did you ever walk into a bar and watch a movie on TV?
Yes.
Well, do you have any, it doesn't make any difference what point you come into the movie. Do you have any problem at all figuring out what's happening?
Not usually, no.
Okay, so that's why you want to get into the middle. You want to take advantage of the human being's capacity to figure things out, for which we legitimately reward ourselves.
So this play starts off with these two, Bill Hollis and Frank Burke, and they're two guys, and they're talking. So that scene was written long ago, or not, or just longer ago than the rest of the play?
I really don't know. And I know it's important to other people, but see, I ask the same questions about things which I don't understand, which amounts to just about everything. But I see somebody do a painting and say, Lord have mercy, why did you do that? I can't believe that. That's such a magnificent thing. So although I know that the answer to any artist is, I'll be darned if I know, I still ask it because I want to get closer to it. But it's the urge to get closer to it, which is the engine of art. As soon as that urge is quenched, the art is over.
And that quenching is whether when you are quenched or when we, the audience, are quenched.
When you're the audience, of course, if you're absolutely sure that you've gotten everything, it's like getting up from this great, great, great restaurant.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely sure that you couldn't eat another bite, right?
Yeah.
That's not how a great restaurant works.
I read in the introduction, so the play poses a question of how much a parent will sacrifice to preserve one of their own. Every play needs something to sell it on, to bring people to some understanding of what they're about to see. What do you start with of saying, okay, this is what this certain play explores, or don't you care about that at all?
No, I couldn't care less. I don't know what introduction you're talking about, but I absolutely...
My introduction, really, I read, and it's basically from the promo copy from the play of what they're using to get people into the seats.
Yeah, no, but that's not how I've made a living for the last 50 years. You don't want to tell people it's not the frickin' teacup ride, you know? You know what you're going to get on the teacup ride. And when you get off the teacup ride, you say, yep, I get it, that's the teacup ride. But what you want to do is entice people in by promising them approach to something which is different than their daily lives, right? And so if you can appeal to something beyond their reason, for example, their fear of the closing door, I better get a ticket because there aren't that many left,
right?
Or their desire to see a mystery, or their desire to see on stage some actor or actress whom they admire. That's what you want to get into the theater, because nobody gets up and they says, honey, look in the theater and see if there's anything on tonight about the uses of diversity and the misuse of capitalism. Would you please?
Well, I mean, the old joke, of course, being that if you start talking about a film cinematography, then the film probably isn't that great. Right. So if you're looking at what it's about, but I do think when you say if you don't know what you're in for, there are certainly playwrights out there. And I'm not using this as a comparison or wanting you to compare to anybody, but there are certainly playwrights and writers out there where you sort of do know what you're going to get. Do you feel that is not of interest, that your work is eclectic enough?
No, I don't know if my work's eclectic at all. I mean, it's my work, you know. The question is, if you could get 10 more people in by taking a survey and changing one line, would you do it? And the answer is no. What about if you could get a million more people in, would you do it? The answer is no, because that's not where the fun is, right?
So the fun in the process for you is what?
The fun in the process is writing. So it's impossible to really understand, especially what dramatic writing is, because you have to be able to do it, right? To say, oh, I get it. I've been butting my head against this. Listen, if you want to write a problem play, anybody can do it. I can do it. You can do it. The dog can do it. Okay. People come to a great people go through moderate difficulties and come to a closer understanding of the real meaning of humanity. Okay. I'd rather punch myself in the nose with a ball-peen hammer, and so would everybody. It's no fun. So people go to that play the same way they used to go to the church. They say, well, I guess it's good for me. It's not going to hurt. I can put up with that for an hour.
Yeah. And you, I would assume, don't want that mindset going in. You want people to be open and to surprise them, to take over from what they may be hardwired to think they're going in to see.
Well, it doesn't matter what they think they're going in to see, because the problem is, the situation is this. As soon as they sit down in the theater, the lights go down, you've got their attention.
Right.
For whatever reason they came, everyone's coming for a different reason. When the lights go down, you've got their attention. The question is, can you keep it for 2 hours? And that's the task of playwriting. And you can't keep it by telling them the same thing over and over or by appealing to their prejudices. That's called a mass rally. That's not theater.
Do you ever, and I think I know the answer to this before I ask it, but I'm curious, do you ever look back at your work as a body of work and say, okay, this is my work, as you said before, this is my work, so there it has that in common, but there are things about these particular plays, this particular novel, this particular work that I'm especially proud of, or don't you think of that that way?
I don't think that I do. You know what happens in directing movies? Once in a while you do something killer. Great idea in directing a movie, and you do something that's so cool that no one's going to notice it. And so one can be very, very proud of that. And I see other people do it in their works, and I say, man, that's great. The problem is that people think, well, I talk so I can act, but they can't. And I can write so I can write drama, but they can't. Because they don't understand what's actually happening to them, which is a kind of a confidence trick is being played. They're being drawn from one moment to the next with the least amount of information possible to make them wonder what happens next and to make them fairly sure that they know until that understanding is shattered in the next moment and they have to start again.
When you started writing in this play, initially you directed it. You directed the first version that you mentioned in 2020. Is that the perfect situation for you when you're directing your own work?
Oh, absolutely. We just had nothing but fun. I was working with all my old friends, and it took about 3 days to put it up. You really don't have to rehearse a play very long, and we did it basically on a bare stage with just a couple of magnificent items in it on the stage, and it was nothing but fun. It was marvelous.
How did this play end up in Great Barrington?
Well, I've known and worked with Jim very, very closely for a long time, maybe close to 40 years, and he's directed my plays. He's acted in many of my plays, acted in many of my movies. He's done my books on audio books. 35 years ago, we founded we did some work for the New England Shelter for Homeless Veterans, and we're very close indeed. And one of the great moments in my life is when he showed up at this little dinky theater in Chicago out of nowhere. I didn't even know he was coming. What a joy. And said, I want to do it in Great Barrington.
So when you say, okay, for you to give it over to somebody else to direct, is that a process for you, or is when you trust the person, it's you don't even think about it?
You got to trust the person, here's what happens. Here's how theater works. On opening night, you end up with two things. You end up with the cast, and you end up with the script.
Yeah.
The direction really doesn't do anything. So what you want is a director who's an actor and a director like Jim who understands direction basically comes down to stand there, say that, then go over there and don't trip over the couch.
It's as simple as that. Have you thought as you go forward that in that directing, when it's the purest form, and you say it doesn't take that long to do it, but there's still work to be done there, because especially with you as also the writer, it's your vision and you are conveying that to the actors who are on stage.
Actually, no. The work, if a play, because I'm so enjoying this, thank you. You're a good sport. The work that the actor, that the writer director might do is on the script while working in the first production. But other than that, you don't have to convey anything. Listen, did you ever read a play?
Of course. Yes, I read this play. Well, yes, yeah.
Well, okay. Is there anything about it you didn't understand?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what?
Well, I mean, so there are things, and I guess you raise an interesting question. There's questions, things that I don't understand maybe at the beginning that become apparent. There are certainly things like that. But also, I have in doing this job for many, many years, and I'm curious about what you think about this. When I talk to directors, when I talk to actors, they talk about this process, like 3 weeks sitting down, reading the play, talking about it, investigating it. So it seems like that process would drive you nuts.
Well, it's a complete waste of time. And I'll tell you how I know is when I was a kid, like many young actors, I did summer stock. And in summer stock, you know, you get the play on a Monday and you put it on Friday. And it's no worse, and it might be better than spending 3 weeks sitting around the table. Because 3 weeks sitting around the table, I don't know if you've ever been subjected to it, it's nonsense. You talk, you don't do anything. But what you do is talk yourself into a position of boredom. Right, so any excitement you might have had about let's just get up and do this stupid thing goes out the window. So why would you want to do that?
Well, that's really interesting because now there were the opposite again. I don't subscribe to this theory. I'm just reporting back to you, but which you already know. But they would also argue that, you know, to understand the work, to fully get it, that you have to, you know, they may or may not have the playwright in the room. The playwright may have been dead for 50 years. Who knows? But they get to the quote unquote essence of the work. The idea of boredom is interested to me because do you think that then transfers to what the audience sees?
Of course it does. Of course it does. The anybody who reads Shakespeare's nothing they don't understand. So what are they sitting around a table for? It's not the audience. It's not the actor's job to delve deeply into the middle of into the play. It's just not their job. It's their job to say the stupid lines. Period. That's it. Some people, when they say the stupid lines, are imbued with a kind of genius that's called talent, right? Some people, if they can say the stupid lines without crudding them up with their own ideas, that's called ability, right? Anyone else is called a hack.
But you have the ability to write a line that, pray tell, isn't stupid. I mean, you can write a line that is a great line, and we don't perceive it to be stupid.
It's not that, the actor has to treat the lines as gibberish. Of course the lines aren't stupid, but the idea is they're there to convey something to the audience, not to convey something to the actor. Because any actor who invests, like the garbage, what do they call the Stanislavski system, they're dissecting every line to understand the truest meaning. But if you think about it, what does the line "I love you" mean? I mean, it might mean I never want to see you again. Or if you say one more word, I'm going to bash your head in. Or I want to take advantage of you. Or I want to take care of you for the rest of my life. Could mean any of those things. We don't know.
I'm curious because you asked me the question. Does it interest you if the audience doesn't or does understand what they are watching at any given moment on stage?
What they have to do is wonder what happens next, which is very different than understanding what's happening on stage.
And so, wanting to know what happens next means that you've got them, right? I mean, that's the idea.
Yeah.
So the creation of this play, again, this goes back to what we were talking about before, of grabbing them in the middle. And then that way you've got them and we find out what happens. But do you want people discussing what that meant on the car ride home? Or don't you care?
I hope they do, but there's one sure way to make sure they don't, and that's to have talkbacks.
Oh, I hate talkbacks. So why don't you like them?
Well, they're an obscenity. They turn the... the talkbacks are the same thing as sitting on a table for 3 weeks, except they're doing that at the other end.
Right.
Because anybody who ever went to a synagogue or a church or something like that, where the people at the end of the sermon could offer comments, none of those comments was anything other than stupid. Because what it meant was that people want to talk, as we all do.
Yeah.
So I say, you want to talk in a car.
Well, and it seems like the talk back, which has become, I don't know, I always look at it sort of through the lens of the director, the actor, or the writer of the playwright, because it just seems torturous for them to hear the response of what they've been working on. So, do it in the car. That seems like a fine idea. Are you ever curious, though, in what is being conveyed? And I guess this is sort of the old question that you get a billion times about reviews, too. I mean, none of that really matters then, does it?
Well, listen, I spent many, many years putting up with reviewers who were, with a couple of exceptions, rabid swine. But so eventually you come to the point where you say, okay, I'm just not going to read. I get it. That's what they are. You know, it's just like having an abusive parent who beats you and puts out his cigarettes. And at a certain point you say, wait a second. I no longer have to figure it out. I get it. I was raised by a sadist.
Yeah.
Okay? There's nothing left to figure out.
But they're interpreting what it is that you have presented before an audience has seen it, which just by its design seems a bit unfair.
Well, look, here's the thing. We have, to a certain extent, a little bit of a free press left. You could say the same thing, that if I were a clothing designer, under the free press, they could take down my clothes and on them, right?
Which right.
It's kind of an equivalent an equivalent situation.
Do you feel, though, that your work has found an audience and a for you a degree of success that you are proud/comfortable with or of?
Well, no, I would like everyone to get up every morning and say, what has Dave done now? I'm not even going to have my coffee until I can figure it out.
Last time I talked to you was 20 years ago, and you had just written a book about living in the state of Vermont, a state I don't think you live in anymore.
No, I've been out of there for many, many years.
Do you miss it at all?
I miss it once in a while, but, you know, it's like you can't go home again. That Vermont that I lived in, it doesn't exist anymore. It was the end of the farm era, and I was living in, you know, in one of the last areas of an actual of actual dairy farms, where they actually milked the cows and put the milk on in cans and drove it down to the creamery, and
yeah.
It was the old the farm life. It was magnificent. The people were superb, you know, and I was an interloper, and they were very kind to me.
Do you feel that way about Chicago or New York, too, that you can't go home again?
Well, I mean, do they still exist, Chicago and New York? I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked at the news last couple of weeks.
They may not. I really don't know. But in California, you're all okay, right? Everything's okay? You're good?
Everything's okay except for the people.
So that would indicate to me you just stay home a lot.
I do. I got this nice little home, thank God. It's a wonderful wife, a couple of poodles, and innumerable bunches of kids, and, you know, thank God.
You know, let me just say this. I greatly enjoyed reading this play. It's a tremendous piece of work. I can't wait to see this group of wonderful actors and Jim do their take on it. I also have to say that I know this is torture for you, and you don't like doing this, and I just so appreciate that you took the time out to talk to us. It's a great honor to me, and I thank you very much for spending the time with us.
Oh, you're so welcome, and it wasn't torture. There was a lot of laughs. I appreciate it.
All right. David Mamet, thank you very much. Thank you. Great Barrington Public Theater presents David Mamet's The Christopher Boys Communion, a performance July 29th through August 8th at the Daniel Art Center at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. GreatBarringtonPublicTheater.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.